Pisans, staunch supporters of the Duke of Brunswick, had sent to intercept him. The Genoese, unlike their Pisan rivals, were enthusiastically Ghibelline, none more so than their leading family, the Dorias, who put their principal palace at the disposal of the emperor-elect until such time as the Alpine passes were once again open to enable him to complete his journey. Meanwhile, an agreement was reached to the benefit of both sides, by the terms of which Frederick promised, in return for a substantial subsidy, to confirm on his accession as emperor all the privileges granted to Genoa by his predecessors. Even then, his path to Germany was not clear. On 28 July, he was given a warm welcome in Pavia, but the Lombard plain was being constantly patrolled by bands of pro-Guelph Milanese, and it was one of these bands that surprised the imperial party as they were leaving the town the next morning. Frederick was lucky indeed to be able to leap onto one of the horses and, fording the river Lambro bareback, to make his way to friendly Cremona, by which route he finally crossed the Alps is not recorded. It was certainly not the Brenner, for we know that the Duke of Brunswick and his army were at Trento. By the beginning of autumn, Frederick was safely in Germany. On 25 July 1215, in the cathedral at Aachen, upon the throne of Charlemagne, the Archbishop of Mainz crowned Frederick King of the Romans, the traditional title of the emperor-elect. He was just 21. All that he now needed for the full imperial title was a further coronation by the Pope in Rome. Almost exactly a year before, on 27 July 1214, the army of Philippe Augustus of France had defeated that of Otto of Brunswick and King John of England on the field of Bouvines near Lille, effectively destroying all Otto's hopes of opposing him. From that day, his supremacy was unquestioned, and it was now, perhaps as a thank offering to God, perhaps as a way of winning further papal approval, that he announced his intention of taking the cross. Few acts in Frederick's life are to us today more incomprehensible. He had never been particularly pious. Moreover, he had been brought up among Muslim scientists and scholars, whose religion he respected and whose language he spoke. Nor, at this time, was he under pressure from the Pope or anyone else. Indeed, there is plenty of reason to believe that he soon regretted his promise. He certainly showed no eagerness to fulfill it. He was, in fact, to remain in Germany for another 4 years, spent largely in ensuring the imperial succession of his son, Henry, who in 1217 arrived with Queen Constance from Sicily. In the late summer of 1220, his parents made their way back to Italy, leaving their disconsolate little 8-year-old behind them. There followed a solemn progress through Italy, during which Frederick dispensed royal grants and diplomas with his usual largesse. In mid-November, he arrived in Rome, and on the 22nd, Pope Honorius III laid the imperial crown on his head. Just 65 years before, his grandfather, Barbarossa, had been obliged to undergo a hole-and-corner coronation, which had been followed by something not far short of a massacre. Those days, however, were long past. This time, Rome was at peace. Frederick's boundless generosity had seen to that, and the ceremony was perhaps the most splendid that had ever been seen in the basilica. When it was completed, and Pope and Emperor emerged into the winter sunshine, it was noted that the emperor, unlike Barbarossa, unhesitatingly grasped the pope's stirrup as he mounted his horse, which he then led by the bridle for a few paces before mounting himself. Such gestures meant little to him. Not only was the empire his own, he had also extracted from the pope an undertaking which he valued very nearly as much, the restoration to him of his Sicilian realm. After 8 years in Germany, he longed to return to Palermo. Those years had brought him the greatest secular title the world could bestow, but they also showed him that he was at heart a man of the South, a Sicilian. Germany had been good to him, but he had never really liked the country or felt at home there. Of his 38 years as emperor, only 9 were to be spent north of the Alps. Throughout his reign, he was to do all he could, though without conspicuous success, to shift the focus of the empire to Italy. And it was in Italy that the main body of his life's work was to be done. He began it in late December 1220, even before he had crossed the Straits of Messina, in the first important city within his northern frontier, the city of Capua. About the state of Sicily, he was under no illusions. For over 30 years, ever since the death of William the Good in 1189, it had been in chaos. His father's reign of terror had only increased the unruliness and dissatisfaction. Then there had been his own minority. His mother, as regent, had barely succeeded in holding things together, followed by his long absence in Germany, during which the state had survived more in name than anything else. As the most urgent priority, order must be restored. It was with what are known as the Assizes of Capua that Frederick took the first steps in doing so, promulgating in no less than 20 chapters a series of laws that he must have pondered for many months before, laws which laid down the foundations for the national regeneration that was to continue for the rest of his reign. Essentially, they involved a return to the status quo existing at the time of William's death, and a recentralization of power under the crown. The most far-reaching law of all was the De Resignatis Privilegiis, which decreed that all privileges, however small or seemingly insignificant, granted to any person or institution since that time should be submitted to the royal chancery for confirmation before the spring of 1221. Obviously, this edict fell hardest on the chief recipients of such privileges, who also constituted the most serious threat to the supremacy of the crown, the nobility and the church. For the nobility, moreover, there were 2 additional blows. No holder of a fief was permitted to marry, nor his children to inherit, without the consent of his sovereign, and all castles built anywhere in the kingdom since King William's death were automatically forfeit to the crown. The proceedings at Capua were repeated, if on a slightly more modest scale, in the following months at Messina, Catania, and Palermo. The emperor then moved on to Syracuse, where he had serious business with the Genoese. Genoa had always been his friend, but as long ago as 1204, Genoese merchants had virtually taken possession of the city, from which they had spread their influence all over the island. One of the chief causes of the decline of Sicilian trade over the previous 30 years had been the fact that most of it had fallen into the hands of foreigners. There was no chance of a return to prosperity while outsiders remained in control. And so, despite the help that he had received from the Genoese on his journey to Germany, Frederick acted with characteristic firmness. He threw them out. His new laws gave him all the authority he needed, all the concessions that had been granted to Genoa, not only in Syracuse, but in Palermo, Messina, Trapani, and other trading centers across the island, were summarily withdrawn. All Genoese depots and warehouses declared confiscate, with their contents, to the Sicilian crown. Similar action was taken against Pisa, although the Pisan presence in Sicily was insignificant and her losses were relatively small. But alas, there was another, far greater enemy than Genoa to be faced, the Muslims of western Sicily. 3/4 of a century before, in the days of King Rogier, the Arab community had been an integral and respected part of the kingdom. It had staffed the entire treasury, and had provided most of the physicians, astronomers, and other men of science who had earned Norman Sicily its outstanding reputation in the field of scholarship. But those days were long gone. Already during the reign of William the Good, much of the semi-autonomous Arab region had been granted to the Abbey of Monreal. With the final collapse of Norman power, the Arabs had found that they were no longer appreciated or even respected. They had consequently been forced back, entrenching themselves in the wild and mountainous West, where Arab brigands and freebooters now constantly terrorized the local Christian communities. Frederick's first campaign against them in the summer of 1221 proved inconclusive. Not until the following year did his troops capture the Saracen fortress of Eato, and with it the Muslim leader Ibn Abbad, who soon afterwards ended his days on the scaffold. Not even his execution, however, marked the final solution to the problem. This came about only between 1222 and 1226, when Frederick adopted a still more drastic measure. He decided to remove the entire Muslim population of the rebellious western region, perhaps 15,000 or 20,000 people, altogether from the island, and to resettle them at the other end of his kingdom, at Lucera in northern Apulia, which became effectively a Muslim town, virtually every one of its Christian churches being replaced by a mosque. This was not, it must be emphasized, in any sense a penal colony. Its citizens enjoyed complete liberty and the free exercise of their religion, and Frederick, who had been brought up with Muslims from his cradle, ultimately built his own palace there, a building in distinctly Oriental style, which was to become one of his favorite residences. The Saracens of Lucera, for their part, showed their new loyalty by providing him with his personal bodyguard. They also manned his principal weapons factory, their swordsmiths producing blades of damascened steel that only Toledo could equal, their carpenters constructing those vast engines of war, catapults, trebuchets, mangonels, and the like, without which effective siege operations were impossible. Meanwhile, their women provided the emperor with his harem, the Saracen dancing girls who lived in considerable luxury in a wing of the palace with their own staff of female servants and a body of eunuchs to see that they came to no harm. A number of these girls would accompany the emperor on his constant travels, and although it was always maintained that they existed only to provide innocent entertainment for the imperial court, there can be little doubt, as Gibbon remarks, on the similar establishment kept by the emperor Gordian, that they were in fact intended for use rather than ostentation. At the time of his imperial coronation in November 1220, Frederick had confirmed to Pope Honorius the promise that he had made after his coronation as King of the Romans, that he would personally lead a new crusade to Palestine, to recover the holy places for Christendom. He could hardly have reneged upon it, yet the confirmation remains surprising, since an expedition gathered by the Pope from various sources had in fact sailed for the East some 2 years before. It had initially been led by the 68-year-old John of Brienne, titular king of Jerusalem. But on the arrival, 4 months late, the papal contingent under the Spanish cardinal Pelagius of St. Lucia, Pelagius had insisted on assuming the overall command. This so-called Fifth Crusade had had as its object the capture of the Egyptian city of Damietta, which it was hoped to exchange later for the holy city itself. The siege of Damietta had been a good deal harder than expected. It lasted in all for 17 months, and just before its end, the Egyptian sultan, Al-Kamil, in desperation, offered the whole kingdom of Jerusalem west of the Jordan in return for the crusaders' departure. Idiotically, as it turned out, this offer was refused by Cardinal Pelagius, who was determined to conquer Cairo and the whole of Egypt. Damietta duly fell on 5 November 1219, but the war dragged on for nearly 2 more years and would have continued even longer had not the crusading army been trapped by Nile floods, from which it extracted itself only by surrender. The crusade, so nearly a success, proved a disaster, thanks entirely to the pig-headedness of its leader. With its failure, the emperor found himself under still greater pressure to initiate another, and also to take another wife. The Empress Constance had died in June 1221, and a year later, the Grand Master of the Teutonic Knights, Hermann of Salza, Duke of Swabia, arrived from the Pope with a proposal that Frederick should now marry Yolande de Brienne, the hereditary queen of Jerusalem, now 12 years old. Her title came from her mother, Maria, the granddaughter of King Amalric I, who at the age of 17 had married the sexagenarian John of Brienne. John had promptly assumed the title of king. After his wife's early death a year or two later, his claim to it was clearly questionable, but he had continued to govern the country as regent for his little daughter Yolande, and, as we have seen, had led the disastrous Fifth Crusade. Frederick was not at first enthusiastic. His proposed bride was penniless and little more than a child. He was more than twice her age. As for her title, few were emptier. Jerusalem had now been in Saracen hands for half a century. There was, on the other hand, at least one strong argument in favor of the idea. The kingship, purely titular as it might be, would greatly strengthen his claim to the city when he eventually left on his long-postponed crusade. And so, after some deliberation, he agreed to the match. He agreed, too, in the course of further discussions with the Pope, that his crusade, to which the marriage was indissolubly linked, would set out on Ascension Day, 15 August 1227. Any further delay, Honorius made clear, would result in his excommunication. It was in August 1225 that 14 galleys of the imperial fleet arrived in Acre, the last surviving outpost of Crusader Outremer, to conduct Yolande to Sicily. Even before her departure, she was married to the emperor by proxy. Next, at Tyree, being now deemed to have come of age, she received her coronation as Queen of Jerusalem. Only then did she embark on the journey which was to take her to a new life, accompanied by a suite which included a female cousin several years her senior. Frederick, together with her father, was waiting for her at Brindisi, where a second marriage took place in the cathedral on 9 November. It was, alas, ill-fated. On the following day, the emperor left the city with his bride and without previously warning his father-in-law. By the time John caught up with him, he was informed by his tearful daughter that her husband had already seduced her cousin. When Frederick and Yolande reached Palermo, the poor girl was immediately packed off to his harem. Her father, meanwhile, had been coldly informed that he was no longer regent. Still less did he have any further rights to the title of king. Whether John's fury was principally due to the emperor's treatment of his daughter or to the loss of his titular kingdom is not clear. At any rate, he went at once to Rome, where Pope Honorius predictably took his side and refused to recognize Frederick's assumption of the royal title. This could hardly have failed to exacerbate the strain in imperial-papal relations, already at an abysmal level owing to Frederick's continued dilatoriness over the long-delayed crusade, originally promised 11 years before, and to his refusal to acknowledge the Pope's authority over North and Central Italy. The quarrel took a further downward plunge when Honorius died in 1227 and was succeeded by Cardinal Hugo of Ostia, who took the name of Gregory IX. Already an old man, Gregory started as he meant to go on. "Take heed," he wrote to Frederick soon after his accession, "that you do not place your intellect, which you have in common with the angels, below your senses, which you have in common with brutes and plants." To the emperor, whose debauches were rapidly becoming legendary, it was an effective shot across the bows. By this time, the crusade was gathering its forces. A constant stream of young German knights was crossing the Alps and pouring down the pilgrim roads of Italy to join the emperor in Apulia, where the army was to take ship for the Holy Land. But then, in the savage heat of an Apulian August, an epidemic broke out. It may have been typhoid, it may have been cholera, but it swept relentlessly through the crusader camps. Frederick had taken the now pregnant Yolande, first to Otranto, then to the little offshore island of St. Andrea for safety. But now he too succumbed to the dread virus. So too did the Landgrave of Thuringia, who had brought with him several hundred cavalry. The two sick men embarked nonetheless and sailed from Brindisi in September. But a day or two later, the Landgrave was dead, and Frederick realized that he himself was too ill to continue. He sent the surviving crusaders ahead with instructions to make what preparations they could. He himself would follow when sufficiently recovered, at the latest by May 1228. Ambassadors were simultaneously dispatched to Rome to explain the situation to the Pope. Gregory, however, refused to receive them. Instead, in a blistering encyclical, he accused the emperor of having blatantly disregarded his crusading vows. Had he not, after repeated postponements, himself set a new date for his departure? Had he not agreed to his own excommunication if he did not fulfill his pledge? Had he not foreseen that, with thousands of soldiers and pilgrims crowded together in the summer heat, an epidemic was inevitable? Had he not, therefore, been responsible for that epidemic, and for all the consequent deaths that it had caused, including that of the Landgrave? And who was to say that he himself had really contracted the disease? Was this not just a further attempt to wriggle out of his obligations? On 29 September, he declared Frederick excommunicate. In doing so, however, he created for himself a new problem. It was self-evident that excommunicates could not lead crusades, and as the weeks passed, it became increasingly clear that this was precisely what Frederick intended to do. Another awkward fact, too, was beginning to emerge. The Pope had badly overplayed his hand. Frederick had replied with an open letter addressed to all those who had taken the cross, explaining his position quietly and reasonably, appealing for understanding and conciliation, setting, in short, an example to the Holy Father of the tone which he would have been well advised to adopt himself. The letter had its effect. When, on Easter Sunday, 1228, Pope Gregory launched into a furious sermon against the emperor, his Roman congregation rioted. Hounded from the city, he was obliged to seek refuge in Viterbo. From there, he continued his campaign. But whereas only a few months before he had been urgently calling Frederick to leave on the crusade, he was now in the ludicrous position of preaching equally urgently against it. Knowing, as he did, that were the emperor to return victorious, papal prestige would sustain a blow from which it would take long indeed to recover. On Wednesday, 28 June 1228, the Emperor Frederick II sailed from Brindisi with a fleet of about 60 ships bound for Palestine. He was now fully restored to health, but his relations with Pope Gregory had not sustained a similar improvement. Indeed, on discovering that he really was preparing for departure, the Pope had fired off another excommunication on 23 March. Yet another was to follow on 30 August. Frederick, meanwhile, had once again become a father. 2 months earlier, his 16-year-old Yolanda had given birth to a boy, Conrad, only to die of puerperal fever a few days later. Poor girl, she had never wanted to be empress and had wept copiously when she had had to leave Palestine. Intellectually, she had nothing to offer to her dazzling polymath of a husband. And he, in turn, had shown little enough consideration for her, at least until he knew that she was carrying his child. She seems to have spent the 30 sad months of her marriage pining for Otomer. Would Frederick have allowed her to accompany him there, had she lived? Did he grieve for her at all? We shall never know. His mind was probably more occupied with the fact that her death had seriously weakened his claim to the Kingdom of Jerusalem. For he was now in precisely the same position as old John of Brienne. If, as he had so stoutly maintained, John had held the title only as a consort of the rightful queen, then so had he. With her death, it should properly pass to her son, the baby Conrad. Conrad, however, was hardly likely to question his father's claim in the foreseeable future, and the emperor had more pressing diplomatic problems to consider. Saladin's empire was at the time controlled by three brothers of his own tribe, the house of Ayyub al-Kamil, Sultan of Egypt, al-Ashraf, generally known as the Sultan of Babylon, with his seat in Baghdad, and al-Mu'azzam, governor of Damascus, with direct authority over Jerusalem and the Holy Land. Al-Mu'azzam, who suspected with good reason that his brothers were planning to unite against him, had recently allied himself with the Khwarazmian Turks and besieged al-Ashraf in his capital. Al-Kamil in Cairo, fearing that he might be next on the list, had secretly appealed to Frederick. If the emperor would drive al-Mu'azzam from Damascus, he himself would be in a position to restore to him the lost territory of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. Frederick had replied sympathetically. It was obviously in his interest to encourage as much division as possible in the Muslim East. And as one who had spent his youth in a partially Muslim environment, understanding the Arab mentality and speaking the Arabic language, he was in an excellent position to do so. Just as he was leaving on the crusade, however, word reached him of al-Mu'azzam's death. It looked in consequence as though al-Kamil's enthusiasm for an alliance was likely to fade. A little over 3 weeks later, on 21 July, the imperial fleet dropped anchor in the harbor of Limassol in Cyprus. Richard Coeur de Lion, having captured it in 1191, had subsequently tried to sell it to the Knights Templar, but on finding that they could not pay for it, had passed it on to Guy of Lusignan, the dispossessed king of Jerusalem. Guy had founded a feudal monarchy, which, surprisingly, perhaps, was to last until the end of the Middle Ages. Technically, there can be little doubt that this monarchy was a fief of the Holy Roman Empire. Guy's brother and successor, Almeric, had done homage for it to Frederick's father, Henry VI. But there were complications, among them the fact that the present king was a minor and that the effective regent, John of Ibelin, was also Lord of Beirut and one of the richest and most powerful magnates of Outremer. Several other members of the Cypriot nobility also possessed considerable estates in Palestine and Syria, and it was important that they should not be antagonized. Frederick, however, could hardly have handled them worse. At first, he was all kindness and consideration, inviting John of Ibelin with the young king and the local lords and barons to a great banquet in the castle of Limassol. It began quietly enough. Then suddenly a body of soldiers with drawn swords entered the hall and took up positions around the walls. In the hush that followed, the emperor rose to his feet and, in a voice of thunder, informed John of Ibelin that he required two things of him. John replied that he would happily comply, so long as he deemed it right. Frederick then demanded, first, the city of Beirut, to which he claimed that John had no title, and, second, all the revenues of Cyprus received since the accession of the young king. These demands were unreasonable enough. The arrogance with which they were pronounced, the obvious attempts at intimidation, while all concerned were, or should have been, protected by the laws of common hospitality, made the effect far, far worse. John replied, giving as good as he got. He held Beirut from the king of Jerusalem. It had no connection with Cyprus. Though he readily acknowledged the emperor's authority over the island, he could not admit similar suzerainty over Syria and Palestine. As for the Cyprus revenues, they were regularly and correctly handed over to the king's mother, Queen Alice, in her capacity as regent. Frederick was angry, but he did not insist. The legal position where the mainland was concerned was indeed far from clear. The Kingdom of Jerusalem had been seriously truncated, one might almost say decapitated, by Saladin's conquest of the Holy City, and had been further weakened by a series of disastrous minorities, several of the barons, including the Ibelin family, were now considerably richer and more powerful than their king and very often acted accordingly. He could not afford to get involved too deeply in such matters. Besides, he was in a hurry. He was well aware that the Pope had his eye on the Sicilian kingdom, and that if he were to prolong his stay in the East, an invasion would not be long in coming. His only hope was to move fast, strike his blow, and return home as soon as possible. He therefore had no choice but to continue his journey, taking the young king of Cyprus with him. He landed in Tyre towards the end of 1228. Impressive detachments of Templars and Hospitallers were there to greet him, still further swelling the ranks of what was already a considerable army. But Frederick had no intention of fighting if his purpose could be achieved by peaceful diplomacy. An embassy was dispatched to Sultan Al-Kamil, who was gradually gaining possession of his dead brother's lands and deeply regretting his former offer. It pointed out that the emperor had come only on the sultan's invitation, but that the world now knew that he was there. How then could he leave empty-handed? The resulting loss of prestige might well prove fatal, and Al-Kamil would never be able to find himself another Christian ally. As for Jerusalem, it was nowadays a relatively insignificant city, defenseless and largely depopulated, even from the religious point of view, far less important to Islam than it was to Christendom. Would its surrender be a small price to pay for peaceful relations between Muslim and Christian, and incidentally, for his own immediate departure? There were no threats, none, at least, outwardly expressed. But the imperial army was on the spot, and its strength was considerable. The Sultan was in an impossible position. The emperor was there on his very doorstep, waiting to collect what had been promised and unlikely to leave until he had got it. Meanwhile, the situation in Syria, where Al-Kamil's continued attempts to capture Damascus were having no effect, was once again causing him increasing alarm. Perhaps an alliance would be no bad thing after all. Finally, the Sultan capitulated, agreeing to a 10-year treaty on certain conditions. First, Jerusalem must remain undefended. The Temple Mount, with the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque opposite it, might be visited by Christians, but must remain in Muslim hands, together with Hebron. The Christians could have their other principal shrines in Bethlehem and Nazareth, on the understanding that they would be linked to the Christian cities of the coast only by a narrow corridor running through what would continue to be Muslim territory. On Saturday, 17 September 1229, Frederick, still under sentence of excommunication, entered Jerusalem and formally took possession of the city. On the following day, in open defiance of the papal ban, he attended Mass in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Deliberately wearing his imperial crown, he had effectively achieved everything he had set out to achieve, and had done so without the shedding of a drop of Christian or Muslim blood. Among the Christian community, a degree of rejoicing might have been expected. Instead, the reaction was one of fury. Frederick, while still under the ban of the church, had dared to set foot in the most sacred shrine of Christendom, which he had won with the collusion of the Sultan of Egypt. The Patriarch of Jerusalem, who had studiously ignored the emperor ever since his arrival, now showed his displeasure by putting the entire city under an interdict. Church services were forbidden. Pilgrims visiting the holy places could no longer count on the remission of their sins. The local barons were outraged that they had not been consulted, and more furious still when they found that the newly restored lands in Galilee were being mostly bestowed on the Teutonic knights in the emperor's suite, rather than on their traditional family owners. How, anyway, they asked themselves, were they expected to retain all these territories that Frederick had so dubiously acquired once the imperial army had returned to the West? The last straw to priest and layman alike was the emperor's obvious interest in and admiration for both the Muslim faith and Islamic civilization as a whole. He insisted, for example, on visiting the Dome of the Rock, of whose architecture he made a detailed study, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, where he is said to have expressed bitter disappointment for not having heard the call to prayer. The Sultan had ordered the muezzins to be silent as a sign of respect. As always, he questioned every educated Muslim he met about his faith, his calling, his way of life, or anything else that occurred to him. To the Christians of Outremer, such an attitude was profoundly shocking. Even the emperor's fluent Arabic was held against him. With every day that he remained in Jerusalem, his unpopularity grew. And when he moved on to Acre, narrowly escaping an ambush by the Templars on the way, he found it on the verge of open rebellion. By this time, he too was in a dangerous mood, shocked by the apparent ingratitude of his fellow Christians and ready to give as good as he got. He ordered his troops to surround Acre, allowing no one to enter or leave. Churchmen who preached sermons against him were bastinadoed. Nor was his temper improved by reports of the invasion of his Italian realm by a papal army under old John of Brienne. Yet another reason to leave this ungrateful land as soon as possible. He ordered his fleet to be made ready to sail on 1 May. Soon after dawn on that day, as he passed through the butcher's quarter to the waiting ships, he was pelted with offal. Only with some difficulty did John of Ibelline, who had now come down to the quayside to bid him farewell, manage to restore order. Stopping only briefly in Cyprus, the emperor reached Brindisi on 10 June. He found his kingdom in a state of helpless confusion. His old enemy, Gregory IX, had taken advantage of his absence to launch what almost amounted to a crusade against him, writing to the princes and churches of Western Europe, demanding men and money for an all-out attack on Frederick's position, both in Germany and in Italy. In Germany, the Pope's attempts to establish a rival emperor in the person of Otto of Brunswick had had little effect. In Italy, on the other hand, he had organized an armed invasion with the object of driving Frederick out of the south once and for all, so that the whole territory could be ruled directly from Rome. Furious fighting was at that moment in progress in Abruzzi and around Capua, while several cities of Apulia, believing the rumors deliberately circulated by papal agents of Frederick's death, were in open revolt. To encourage others to follow their example, Gregory had recently published an edict releasing all the emperor's subjects from their oaths of allegiance. The situation could hardly have been more serious, yet from the moment of Frederick's arrival, the tide began to turn. Here was the emperor once again among his people, not dead but triumphant, having recovered without bloodshed the holy places for Christendom. His achievement may not have impressed the Christian communities of Outremer, but to the people of South Italy and Sicily, it appeared in a very different light. Moreover, with his return to the kingdom, Frederick himself instantly became a changed man. Gone were the anger, the bluster, the insecurity, the lack of understanding. He was back now in a land he knew and deeply loved. Once again, he was in control. All that summer he spent tirelessly on campaign, and by the end of October, the papal army was broken. Gregory IX, however, was not, and the final reconciliation between the two was a long, difficult, and painful process. In the months that followed, Frederick made concession after concession, knowing, as he did, that the obstinate old pope still retained his most damaging weapon. He was still excommunicated, a serious embarrassment, a permanent reproach, and a potentially dangerous diplomatic liability. As a Christian, too, insofar as he was one, Frederick would have had no wish to die under the ban of the church. But still Gregory prevaricated. It was not until July 1230 that, very reluctantly, he agreed to a peace treaty, signed at Soprano, at the end of August, and lifted his sentence. 2 months later, still, the two men dined together in the papal palace at Anagni. The dinner, one feels, must have been far from convivial, at least at first, but Frederick was capable of enormous charm when he wanted to use it, and the Pope seems to have been genuinely gratified that the Holy Roman Emperor should have taken the trouble to visit him, informally and without pomp. So ended yet another of those Herculean struggles between emperor and pope, on which the history of medieval Europe so frequently seems to turn. In 1231, Frederick was in a position to promulgate what came to be known as the Constitutions of Melphi, no less than a complete new codification of the law on a scale unattempted since the days of Justinian 7 centuries before. The emperor took full control of criminal justice, instituted a body of itinerant judges acting in his name, curtailed the liberties of the barons, the clergy, and the towns, and laid the foundations of a system of firm government paralleled only in England, with similar representation of nobility, churchmen, and citizens. The truth was that, of all his dominions, the Regno, as the Kingdom of Sicily was generally known, was the least troublesome. He had been born there. He knew every inch of it. He understood its people. Things were very different in the two other great regions subject to his rule, North Italy and Germany, in which imperial power, having no solid basis of the kind which England and France, with their firmly hereditary monarchies, were rapidly building up, had declined dramatically over the previous 100 years. In North Italy in particular, the great Lombard cities and towns had been a perennial thorn in the flesh to successive emperors, none of whom had suffered more than Frederick's own grandfather, Barbarossa, soundly defeated at Legnano little more than half a century before. To maintain their independence, their most successful policy had always been to play Pope and Emperor off against each other. News of the reconciliation of 1230 had consequently filled them with dismay. The Lombard League had been hastily revived, its members closing ranks against the coming danger. They had been right to do so. Had Frederick been willing to divide his empire, allotting Germany to himself and entrusting Sicily to his son Henry, or even vice versa, North Italy might have been left to its own devices. But that was not his way. Determined as he was to rule both territories himself, he knew that a safe overland route between them was essential. And there was another reason, too. For him, Italy was more important than Germany would ever be. This was, after all, the Holy Roman Empire, not the Holy German. Its capital belonged in Rome, and to Rome, one day, he hoped to transfer it. As a first step towards this objective, the emperor summoned his son Henry, all the principal German princes, and the representatives of the great cities of North Italy to a council, to be held in Ravenna on All Saints' Day, 1 November 1231. He did everything he could to allay Lombard's fears. He undertook to bring no military escort, only a small personal suite. The proceedings would be dedicated to the honor of God, the Church, and the Empire, and the prosperity of Lombardy. Doubtless he meant every word, but for the Lombard leaders, the alarm signal was unmistakable. They did not want him, still less did they want a horde of truculent German barons. Instantly they closed the Alpine passes. The measure was not entirely successful. A good many of the delegates managed to circumvent the blockade and make their way round by an eastern route through Friuli, but it delayed the conference by a good 2 months. For all that, the delegates celebrated Christmas with a round of elaborate festivities and displays, including special exhibitions of the emperor's famous menagerie, which accompanied him on all his travels, and which included not only his unrivaled collection of falcons, but lions, panthers, camels, apes, and monkeys, and even an elephant, whose effect on the local peasantry is not easy to imagine. Frederick was always good at putting on a show. He was conscious, however, that one delegate remained absent, and that delegate, the most important of all, his son Henry, King of the Romans. Henry had sent no message of explanation, let alone of apology, and it soon became clear that he had made no effort to answer his father's summons. The cause may well have been sheer embarrassment. This is not the place to discuss the imperial administration in Germany. Suffice it to say that Henry had been left by his father as titular sovereign at the age of 8. In consequence, when he came of age at 18, he felt little affection or loyalty towards a father of whom he had only vague childhood recollections. By adopting towards the German princes a confrontational policy diametrically opposite to that followed by Frederick, he had already succeeded in dangerously antagonizing them, and when matters came to a head in 1231, they had extracted from him a whole series of rights and privileges, thus seriously weakening imperial power in Germany. Furious, Frederick called another council for the following summer in Aquileia, making it clear that his son would ignore the summons at his peril. This time, Henry dared not disobey, and was forced to swear an oath that he would henceforth defend the rights and standing of the emperor, dismissing those counselors who had encouraged him in his disastrous policies. But if Frederick thought that with a submissive son and well-disposed princes he could subdue Lombardy, he was wrong. Most of the last 19 years of his life were to be spent in warfare up and down the Italian peninsula, striving as his grandfather had striven before him to establish his authority. There was, however, an important difference between them. Frederick Barbarossa had been a German through and through. His empire was a German empire. For Frederick II, Italy always came first, despite the occasional temporary reconciliation this guaranteed the hostility of the Pope. Uncomfortably squeezed as he was between the two nominally imperial territories, Lombardy and the Regno. Over those last years, many of the leading characters would be replaced. Henry, King of the Romans, after further acts of disobedience, was dethroned in 1235, and was succeeded 2 years later by his half-brother, Conrad. That same year, Frederick himself remarried, taking as his third wife, Isabella, sister of King Henry III of England. Pope Gregory, having excommunicated Frederick yet again in 1239, died in 1241. If his successor, the hopeless old Celestine IV, had lived, Frederick's worries might have been almost at an end. But after just 17 days, Celestine had followed Gregory to the grave. For the next year and a half, the emperor, while simultaneously preparing a huge fleet to sail against Genoa and Venice, did everything he could to influence the next election, but in vain. The Genoese cardinal, Sinibaldo de' Feici, who in June 1243 became Pope Innocent IV, proved, if anything, an even more determined adversary than Gregory had been. Only 2 years after his accession at a general council in Lyon, he declared the already excommunicated Frederick deposed, stripping him of all his dignities and titles. But emperors could not be thrown out so easily. The Hohenstaufen name retained immense prestige in Germany, while in the Regno, Frederick's endless peregrinations ensured him a constantly high profile to the point where he seemed omnipresent, part of life itself. Loftily ignoring the papal pronouncement, he continued the struggle. It was still in progress when, in December 1250, he was seized by a sudden violent attack of dysentery at Castle Fiorentino in Apulia. He died a few days later on Tuesday, 13 December, just 13 days short of his 56th birthday. Inevitably, there were rumors of poison, but no real evidence has ever been put forward. His body was taken to Palermo, where, at his request, it was buried in the cathedral in the magnificent porphyry sarcophagus that had been prepared for his grandfather, Roger II, at his own foundation in Cefalù, but had till then remained unoccupied. As his heir in Germany and the Regno, Frederick had named Conrad, son of Yolanda, of Jerusalem, and during Conrad's absence in Germany, he had entrusted the government of Italy and Sicily to Manfred, the favorite of his 11 illegitimate children. Manfred proved a worthy scion of his father. He recreated Frederick's brilliant court, founded the Apulian port of Manfredonia, and married his own daughter, Helena, to Michael II, despot of Epirus, an alliance which gained him the island of Corfu and a considerable stretch of the Albanian coast, including the historic city and port of Durazzo. Another daughter, Constance, became the wife of Peter, heir to the throne of Aragon, the second Constance of Aragon to rate mention in this chapter. Even after his half-brother Conrad died in 1254, Manfred did not, to the Pope's inexpressible relief, seek authority over northern or central Italy. Nevertheless, his increasing power in the south could not but reawaken anxieties in Rome, and these became greater still when, in August 1258, he prevailed upon the Sicilian baronage to proclaim him king. Ever since Frederick's theoretical deposition in 1245, Pope Innocent had been seeking an athlete of Christ who would rid South Italy once and for all of the House of Hohenstaufen and lead the army of the Church to victory in the peninsula. Richard, Earl of Cornwall, the brother of King Henry III and the richest man in England, he had been elected King of the Romans in 1257, had at one moment seemed a possibility, but Innocent had been unable to persuade him to take up the challenge. The Pope was still trying to find a suitable candidate when he died in 1261, to be succeeded by Urban IV, the first Frenchman to occupy the papal throne. Urban's eyes soon fell on a compatriot, Charles of Anjou. The brother of King Louis IX, Charles was now 35. In 1246, he had acquired through his wife the country of Provence, which had brought him untold wealth. He was also lord of Inter Alia, of the thriving port of Marseille. To this cold, cruel, and vastly ambitious opportunist, the Pope was now offering a chance not to be missed. The army which Charles was to lead against Manfred, and which began to assemble in North Italy in the autumn of 1265, was to be officially designated a crusade, which meant that it would be, as always, something of a ragbag with the usual admixture of adventurers hoping to secure fiefdoms in South Italy, pilgrims seeking the remission of their sins, and ruffians simply out for plunder. With them, however, was an impressive number of knights from all over Western Europe, French, German, Spanish, Italian, and Provençal, with even a few Englishmen thrown in for good measure, who Charles firmly believed would be more than a match for anything that Manfred could fling against them. On 6 January 1266, Pope Urban crowned Charles of Anjou with the crown of Sicily. Less than a month afterwards, on 3 February, Charles's army crossed the frontier into the Regno. This time, there was to be no long campaign. The two armies met on the 26th outside the old Roman city of Benevento, and it was all over quite quickly. Manfred, courageous as always, stood his ground and went down fighting, but his troops, hopelessly outnumbered, soon fled from the field. The battle had been decisive. The crusade was over. And so, or very nearly, was the House of Hohenstaufen. 2 years later, King Conrad's son, Conrad IV, better known as Conradin, and Prince Henry of Castile, made a last desperate attempt to save the situation, leading an army of Germans, Italians, and Spaniards into the Regno. Charles hurried up and met them at the border village of Tagliacozzo. This time, the battle, which was fought on 23 August 1268, proved a good deal harder, resulting in hideous slaughter on both sides. Eventually, the Angevins once again won the day. Conradin escaped from the field but was captured soon afterwards. There followed a show trial in Naples, after which, on 29 October, the young prince, he was just 16, and several of his companions were taken down to the marketplace and beheaded on the spot. Manfred and Conradin were both, in their own different ways, heroes. It was hardly their fault that they were overshadowed by their father and grandfather. So, after all, was much of the known world. Fluency in six languages was an even rarer accomplishment in the 13th century than it is today. In addition, Frederick was a sensitive lyric poet at whose court the sonnet was invented, a generous patron of the arts, a skilled general, a subtle statesman, and the greatest naturalist of his time. A passionate intellectual, curiosity gave him a more than passing knowledge of philosophy and astronomy, geometry and algebra, medicine and the physical sciences. Not the least remarkable of his qualities was his talent for showmanship. His force of character alone, the sheer dazzle of his personality, would always have ensured that he impressed himself on anyone with whom he came in contact. But he deliberately built up his image still further, with that extraordinary menagerie, with his personal regiment of Saracen, even with his harem. These last two attributes were regularly held against him by his enemies, but they too carried a clear message. The emperor was not as other men. He was a giant, a demigod, to whom the accepted rules of conduct did not apply. In a word, he had style. And style has always been, as it still is today, a specialty of the Italians. Frederick was probably one of the first men, and in all history there have been surprisingly few, to have had a foot in both worlds, the Italian and the German, and to feel equally at ease on either side of the Alps. But his heart remained in Italy, where he spent most of his life, and it is as an Italian that he finds his place in this audiobook. Culturally, he gave the country much. Had the Provençal troubadours, fleeing from the horrors of the Albigensian Crusade, not found a warm welcome at the court of Palermo, and fired the local poets with their ideals of courtly love, Italian literature might have taken a diametrically different course, and the Divine Comedy might never have been written. In the field of architecture, too, he was an innovator. The immense fortified gateway to his frontier city of Capua, built to defend its bridge across the Volturno River and designed by the emperor himself, no longer stands, but much of its sculpture is preserved in the local museum, from which it is clear that the emperor drew liberally on the decorative language of ancient Rome, pre-echoing the Renaissance well over a century before its time. Classical pediments and pilasters appear even more remarkably in his magnificent hunting box of Castel del Monte, a vast turreted octagon in limestone crowning a remote Apulian hilltop. But perhaps we are wrong to be surprised. Frederick was, after all, a Roman emperor, and he was determined that we should not forget it. Politically, on the other hand, he was a failure. His dream had been to make Italy and Sicily a united kingdom within the empire, with its capital at Rome, the overriding purpose of the papacy, aided by the cities and towns of Lombardy, was to ensure that that dream should never be realized. It was unfortunate for the emperor that he should have had to contend with two such able and determined men as Gregory and Innocent. But in the long run, the struggle could have had no other outcome. The empire, even in Germany, had lost its strength and cohesion. No longer could the loyalty of the German princes be relied upon, or even their deep concern. As for North and Central Italy, the Lombard cities would never again submit to imperial bluster. Had Frederick only accepted this fact, the threat to the papacy would have been removed, and his beloved Regno might well have been preserved. Alas, he rejected it, and in doing so, he not only lost Italy, he signed the death warrant of his dynasty. Chapter 10. The End of Ortimer. No two contemporary European rulers have been more different than the Emperor Frederick II and King Louis IX of France. Frederick was an intellectual and a free thinker. He had little respect for religion. Indeed, he spent a good deal of his life under the ban of the church. He could, on occasion, take a strong line with heretics, particularly if they threatened the peace or security of the empire. At the same time, having been raised in the court of Palermo among Arabs and Greeks, he had a deep respect and understanding both of Islam and of Eastern Orthodoxy, and liked nothing better than to discuss the finer points of theology with scholars of the two faiths. As a statesman, he was by no means without principle. He was also a pragmatist, and he knew full well that if he and his empire were to survive, he simply could not afford too delicate a conscience. In appearance, he had never been handsome, broad and stocky, with thin reddish hair. Physically, he was hard as nails. King Louis IX, on the other hand, was a saint and looked it. A contemporary friar who saw